Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on freedom of speech when we come back. You know, Charles Lyell was one of the modern pillars of geology, and he published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated these ideas. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins has been devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes back through time indefinitely. And in that way, catastrophes like Noah's flood have been strictly ruled out. Now, this process is called science. Well, listen to this. The sun is shrinking. That was a Newswire report, and it made that surprising statement. The sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century. Scientists have been watching for over 100 years now, and the evidence is conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking by about 5 feet. So if the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, 0.1% per century, then it totals 1% per millennium. If the sun existed only 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter. If it existed just 20 million years ago, then the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth. The sun would be touching the Earth just 20 million years ago. And that's as far as researchers can tell at this rate of shrinkage. It has been going on since the origin of the sun. Now listen to this. What did our teachers tell us about the extinction of the dinosaurs? They told us that it was 65 million years ago. But yet, 20 million years ago, just measuring the shrinkage of the sun would have been touching the Earth, which is 93 million miles in diameter. Now, you can't have it both ways, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on these kinds of pseudo-scientific lies. And it's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the banner of science. And it's one more of the many lessons that we teach in our Mosaic Law School, conducted twice a year here in Isabella, Missouri. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we're talking about free speech, freedom of speech. We would be remiss if we didn't look at the other side of freedom of speech and talk a little about freedom to remain silent. There's a lot said in Anglo-Saxon administration about the right to remain silent. In fact, here in the United States, we have a constitutional provision. It's built into our Bill of Rights, where a defendant does not have to testify either for himself in his own defense or against himself by speaking against his will. So we have a right to remain silent. In fact, we have a famous case called Miranda versus Arizona. Now, the police would like you to speak, and they want you to talk, and there's a reason for that. The reason is that 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is false. I know that's a shocker. When I tell people that here in class, you know, they gasp and they say, that can't be true. If that were true, then I would be a liar. So I like to ask people oftentimes in class, are you a liar? And nobody raises their hands. Once in a while, some guy that's in on the story knows and he raises his hand. But most people, if you were to ask them, are you a liar, they would deny it. They would say, no, I'm not a liar. Now, in the scripture, there's a famous clause that says, let God be true, though every man be found a liar. And the scripture says, thy word is truth. Now, the Bible, then, is, here's your creator telling you that the scripture's true, but you're not. You're a liar. If that's true, then it must be pathological. I'm just saying, if that's true. Most of you don't believe it, but I just said, if that's true, then your lying then would be pathological. It would be something beyond your control. Now, most people like to think of themselves as being true and honest men, true and honest in their speech. That is, we don't lie. We tell the truth. All you have to do is start off by asking the question, have you ever told a lie just one time in your life? Any time in the past, just one time. If you said, no, I have never told a lie in my entire life, all of us would sit there and look at you and say, we know you are a liar. There's your first lie right there. Actually, it's your second one, but we would know that you were lying. Now, if that's true, you have lied at least one time in the past, then you are at least a past tense liar. Now, if I were to ask you this question, do you think that in the rest of your life, no matter how long or short that may be, you might lie just one more time? Could you envision yourself falsifying some statement to somebody in the future? And we don't know how long or how far in the future that might be, but if your answer was, no, I will never tell a lie as long as I live, you see, instantly we would know you're a liar again. Now, this is your second lie. I've never told a lie in the past, and I will never tell a lie in the future. You know, right away, we all know that's not true now, don't we? So now we have to have one more to cover. That's present tense. Have you told any lies in the recent past? You know, like yesterday, day before. Did you tell your wife what a wonderful casserole that was when in reality you thought it was real garbage? You know, these are called little white lies. We do it in polite society. Gee, you look marvelous today, sweetheart. Actually, she looks like a frump, but, you know, you don't want to start a fight this morning. Oh, you really look great. And so, you know, your wife always asks you that, doesn't she? She comes out and she says, how do I look? Men don't do that. Men don't walk out and say, gee, honey, how do I look? I look like I always look. I dress like I always dress. And if there's somebody who doesn't like it, they can lump it. Women are different. See, they have to have approval. And so they say, well, how do I look? Oh, you look marvelous. I don't know that she looks marvelous. She looks like she always looks. She looks fine to me. But that doesn't mean that it's out of the ordinary. But I want to make her feel good, so I tell her, well, you look fabulous. That's not true. She doesn't look fabulous. She doesn't look marvelous. She looks just everyday garden variety. So you lied again. Now, we do this constantly. We like to deceive ourselves into believing that we're true and honest. We are admitted liars in the past, admitted liars in the future, and if you were honest, you'd say, well, yeah, once in a while I tell a white lie in the present. Now listen, you're a liar past, present, and future. What in the hell more do we need? Are you a liar? The answer should be pretty obvious. Now, the police know that, and a fellow by the name of Professor Swift came up with an interesting study back in 1918. He was looking into this thing of testimony, and so he published his findings, and what he discovered was that 25% of what you're telling, if it's something that you want to tell the truth about, it's not something that you're trying to hide, like the casserole was really delicious when in fact it really wasn't. See, that's something that you want to hide. In this case, Professor Swift went to people and asked them questions about testimony that they had given in court when they wanted to tell the truth. They were just mightily striving to do everything in their power to relate the events that they saw, they heard, or they knew, and try to relate that to the court. They're just working their hearts out trying to tell the truth. And what they discovered was is that these people were lying, or the report they were giving was false. We'll give them the benefit of the doubt. We won't call them liars. We're just giving a false report 25% of the time. That was revolutionary back in 1918. Today, it's common. We do this today. And the way we do it is we take two cameras at two different angles, and then we videotape an event. The one I'm going to relate to you, it's an event concerning two families with four children who are having a picnic by the lake with a power boat and they're water skiing. And then for 60 minutes, they videotape this event. And you're free to sit there, you and all the rest of the students, you're all free to sit there with your notepads. You can have a pen, you can take notes. I mean, you can sit there and watch the events and write them down. You do this for 60 minutes, and then they take you away from the scene and sit you down, and they say, now I want to debrief you, I want to depose you, I want to ask you some questions. So they give you 100 questions concerning what you have just seen. Now, we have the entire scene down on videotape, but we're going to ask you questions like, well, how many adults were there? And then from your memory, you write down, well, let's see, there was two families here. There was two women, two men. There's four adults. Okay, how many children were there? Well, there's four children. There was two girls and two boys. Then they'll ask you, well, how many females were present and how many males? All right, you think you've already got the answer down because, you know, there were two wives, two husbands, two girls and two boys. But maybe that wasn't the case. Maybe the children were three males and one female. And you didn't remember that. And so you answer. After all, we're asking you the question, how many children were present? Four. How many were girls? How many were boys? Then they'll ask you, what was the color of the boat? What was the brand name on the outboard motor? Was the boat powered by an outboard motor or an inboard motor? Well, now, if the boat was powered by an inboard motor, then obviously there wasn't an outboard sign on there, like, you know, a Johnson outboard, you know, or a Yamaha. But if you saw a Yamaha or Johnson, well, then obviously it wasn't an inboard. Now, did you observe that engine on the boat? And if so, what brand was it? Now, people, when they're eyewitnesses, like to tell you, they like to testify, they like to point out, that they were very observant. They noticed things like the color of the boat and the brand of the motor. And were they slalom skiing or were they using two skis? And just goes on and on, and you're going to answer these questions. And when you get all through answering these questions, and they come back and they grade them. And that's because, you see, before we put on this show, we knew whether this was a Yamaha or a Johnson. We knew whether it was an inboard or an outboard. We knew whether the boat was white or black. We knew whether there were two women or two men, because this was all staged. Remember, this is a test. And so when we get through, we grade your paper. And if you're average, 75 of your answers will be true, and 25 of your answers will be false. And when we tell you that 25 of your answers are false, you will react by saying, but I was an eyewitness. I know what I saw. That's your natural reaction. Then we can play the videotape back so that you can see these 25 false statements. And do you know what your reaction will be? You have dummied up. You have phonied. You have used trick photography to do this. That's what your reaction will be. And that's because your subconscious mind is very powerful. You actually believe your own lies. That's what the bottom line is. So that's why God told you, you know, let God be true, though every man be found a liar. That's because you're built that way. You're designed that way. Now, when we talk about free speech, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the freedom to remain silent. The freedom to remain silent. Now, we've built that into our Constitution. And the police know that, and the police know that in order to convict you, they have to get the evidence from you, because all of the evidence that's ever going to be created in this case, all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. There isn't anybody else out there to produce evidence against you. If you robbed a bank, you know, you were either there or you weren't. That's either you on that video camera or it isn't. That's either a gun in your hand or it isn't. And then when the police question you and they say, well, where were you? And so maybe you were down at Flo's whorehouse. And you don't want your wife to know that you were down at the whorehouse. And so you lie and you say, well, I was at the movies. Okay, well, what movie did you go to? Well, I was at the Bijou movie. What was playing? See? Now, you're lying. Not that you're lying about the bank robbery. The police have arrested you because you look like the guy that's on the video camera. But you see, they got you lying because you were actually doing something wrong, or you were doing something that you didn't want everybody out there in the world to know about. And so you lied. Now that you've lied about the whorehouse and the Bijou Theater, they're going to present that to the jury. That when he was asked, did you rob the bank? He said, no. And where were you? And instead of telling the truth that you were at the whorehouse with Margaret, you were really down at the Bijou Theater, which in fact, you weren't down at the Bijou Theater. You were in fact with Margaret down at Flo's. See? And so now the jury says, well, that guy can't be believed. Now that's a direct intentional lie. See? You were lying on purpose. That's why it's necessary for you to remain silent. And that's because the police, when they come into the interrogation, they're fresh. Did you notice what they did to these detainees down at Guantanamo? They used sleep deprivation. So they take this guy, when he hasn't had any sleep for 3 days, bring him in to interrogate him, and then they bring in a fresh interrogator. You know, he's just woke up, showered, he's fresh and alert. He comes in and asks you questions, and then you're sitting here groggy, and you're answering these questions, and you're contradicting yourself. And then there is a reporter over there, and she's writing down every word. They got a tape recorder in here. And then they face you with your contradictions. And then you're trying to explain your contradictions, and then the next part of the story is you're explaining all of your lies upon lies upon lies until your credibility is totally shot. Hell, you don't even believe yourself anymore. And then they use that against you in your trial, you see. And this is why our founding fathers took a look at this and said, now, wait a minute. If a guy's brought in for bank robbery and he wants to remain silent, here's what we want to do to level the playing field. If the guy wants to confess, yes, I was down at the bank and I was short of money and so I robbed the bank. That's fine. We don't have any objection. Even God himself says that you should confess your sin and flee from it. That's really good. But if for some reason you decide, no, I don't want to confess, should you be compelled to confess? Now, the Bush administration said, yes, we think that free speech should include waterboarding and torture because this guy's got information that we want. And we want this guy to testify. We want this guy to give us the information that we want. And so if he says, no, I'm not going to, we're going to use what's called in America pain compliance. See, here in America, we do not torture people. So if you're living in Brazil or Buenos Aires or Tokyo, Japan, just wanted you to know, here in America, we do not torture people. We use pain. We apply pain until you tell me what I want to know. And we call that pain compliance. See? Now, the Bush administration called this enhanced interrogation. See how we do that? Enhanced interrogation. What we do here in America, we just change the name. We turn it around a little bit. And then we deceive ourselves into believing, well, we're not out here torturing people. We're out here using enhanced interrogation techniques. All right. This is very common. And years ago, there was a famous case came down here called Miranda versus Arizona. And the Supreme Court discovered, through intense investigation, that the police departments were using pain compliance, enhanced interrogation techniques, commonly known as torture, in other places in the world. Now, Americans believe that torture isn't used in America, hasn't been until the Bush administration. You people are out of touch with reality. Now, you people have been going to church for so long that you haven't got your heads on straight. Torture in this country, the United States, is as common as pig tracks in a barnyard. It's used every day. Every day. And the Supreme Court came to the conclusion that there were 40,000 police agencies in this country back in the 1960s. I said 40,000. And that every one of those police agencies was violating somebody's civil rights once every day. Now that's 40,000 violations a day. 40,000 police departments times one violation per day times 365 days in the year is 14,600,000 criminal acts perpetrated against the citizens of the United States by the police. Now, when we go to the FBI crime statistics, they inform us that there are about 14 million crimes committed in the United States by real criminals, not the pretenders in the police department who are committing 14,600,000 crimes a year. These are the real criminals. This is the mafia. This is the guy that's breaking into your house at night. So the drug dealers and so on. All these real criminals out there, they commit 14 million. Now, it doesn't take a real genius to figure out that the police create and cause and perpetrate more crime than the real criminals. Well, you know, not by much, but by 600,000 crimes a year. And then it's these same policemen over here that are trying to force confessions out of people by using enhanced interrogation in order to get those people to confess to crimes. And they use all kinds of techniques, but, you know, free speech is one of those techniques. What they're trying to do is to get you to speak. So they start off by telling you that you have to, that it's the law, that there's some law involved. And there's a case called Brown versus Texas that I wanted to share with you because freedom of speech is very important. And people ask me, why is it that I tolerate other people criticizing me by publishing their material in my material? And the answer that I've been giving you is that freedom of speech is the cornerstone of freedom. It creates the ability for you to choose, and your ability to choose is what freedom is all about. Without freedom of speech, there isn't any freedom. You know, freedom isn't made up of just one or two or three things. It's made up of a number of elements that, working in concert together, create freedom. And your freedom to be free from coercion is an essential element to freedom. Your right to remain silent is an essential element to freedom. Your right to speak is an essential element to freedom. your right to act, travel. All of these working in concert is what makes what we call the American lifestyle or the American way of life worth living. It's because we have freedom. But there's this constant attack on freedom. And the attack on freedom and your state of freedom in every case throughout history is always made by government and government officials. Look, wait a minute, guys. It's not some longshoreman or truck driver or some Hell's Angel out there that is trying to compel a confession out of you. It's your local policeman. It isn't some dirty, burly truck driver out there who's trying to withhold your freedom of speech. It's your government legislators who enacted this law called hate speech legislation. They're the ones that are trying to throttle your ability to speak freely. Hell, it's not some guy or some group out here in society. It's the police, it's the public officials, it's the mayor, the city council, it's the FBI. These are the people that are the threats to your freedom of speech. It's Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and President Obama that are the threats to your freedom of speech or your freedom to remain silent, because these are the people who submit or subject you to enhanced interrogation at Guantanamo or in your local police station. Now, there are ways to counter this. That's my point. It's not the state of the law. It is the state of what we believe the law is. So let's take a look at this freedom to remain silent. Two police officers, while cruising near noon in a patrol car, observed the appellant and another man walking away from one another in an alley in an area with a high incidence of drug traffic. So they stopped and they asked the appellant to identify himself and to explain what he was doing. One officer testified that he stopped the appellant because the situation looked suspicious, and we had never seen that subject in that area before. The officers did not claim to suspect the appellant of any specific misconduct, nor did they have any reason to believe that he was armed. So when the appellant refused to identify himself, he was arrested for violation of a Texas statute which makes it a criminal act for a person to refuse to give his name and his address to an officer who has lawfully stopped him and requested the information. Now, the appellant's motion to set aside an information charging him with violation of the statute on the grounds that the statute violated the First, the Fourth, the Fifth, and the 14th Amendments was denied, and then he was convicted, and he was fined. Now I'll pause right here and make an editorial comment. This is called Brown versus Texas. Brown v. Texas, cited at 443 U.S. 47. It's a very important case. It, along with Lawson versus Colander, and a new case now called Heibel versus Nevada, are the foundation of the concept of your duty to identify yourself to a police officer. 24 states in the Union have statutes like Texas that require you to identify yourself to the policeman. 26 states do not. But yet, in every state in the Union, when the policeman stops you and says, "Give me your identification," 100% of the time, you reach in your pocket, pull out your driver's license, and hand it to the policeman. You don't have any duty to do that, but you do because you believe that that's the law, and you believe you have to. That's the first element in testifying against yourself. The very first element. Let me tell you who I am. Let me tell you where I live. And then he wants to know, well, where do you work? And what's your social security number? And who are you married to? And are you married? And how many children do you have? And the questioning goes on. And the questioning, when it begins, is totally innocuous. It doesn't have anything to do with your crime. But it tells the police officer a lot of background information. Maybe some background information that you just assumed that he didn't have. And then he starts looking for a warrant for your arrest. Well, he couldn't look for the warrant for your arrest until he first knew who you were, what your social security number was. He needed to know your name, address, social security number, and your birth date in order to plug into NCIC to find out if there's any outstanding warrants. Now, the Fifth Amendment protects you against testifying against yourself. You're walking down the street, the policeman stops you and says, hey, give me your identification so I can put an NCIC check and see whether or not there's any warrants for your arrest. Hell, this is just a fishing expedition. Nothing more, nothing less. It's like a Delaware versus Prowse random stop on the highway. Is it legal? Well, it's totally illegal and you can't do that, but do the police do it anyway? Every day. Constantly. Hell, 99% of the police actions are illegal. How do I know that? Hell, I've been in this business for 25 years. It's just common. Do it every day. Now, once in a while, there's a Brown v. Texas. Once in a great while, there's a Miranda versus Arizona that calls them up short and says, hey, you can't do that. But how many of you people out there have ever read Brown v. Texas or Lawson versus Colander or Miranda versus Arizona? You know, unless you're a law school student or unless you've studied law or you're some kind of a pro se litigant, you couldn't find those cases at high noon with both hands and a road map. And yet, those are the foundation documents, these judicial opinions and decisions, as to what your relationship is to the police and about your rights to freedom of speech or freedom to remain silent, which is the cornerstone of your free existence. And this is why I tell people, you know, very seldom do people have freedom. Because your rights are only accorded to those who are the belligerent claimants in person and who know what their rights are. Most people haven't got a clue as to what their rights are. They went to preschool, they went to public school, and when they got out, they went to college, and when they got out of college, they went to work for Standard Oil. They haven't got any idea as to whether or not they have to speak to the policeman. They don't know what the statutes are in their state. They don't know anything about Brown v. Texas. They've had a liberal arts education. All right, with that in mind, let me pause here and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct, at least to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate. We should keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. However, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about freedom of speech generally when students go through the paperwork that we furnish here with our CD program. Every one of these schools now has one or more binders with about 500 to 1,000 pages of material. And I always tell people, you can't believe what I tell you because 25% of what comes out of my mouth is false. So in court, in judicial proceedings, instead of relying upon hearsay or parole evidence or parole testimony, what we rely upon is, do you have the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence? Have you got a document to support that? Who else believes that? Where did you get that information? Now, when we rely upon documentation, you know, where's the contract? What was the intent of the contractors and contractees at the time that they made this agreement? Let's read it. Now, by doing that, we come to a closer examination of what the truth really is. And by remaining silent, what you're doing here is you're keeping away from your opponent the evidence or the information that he's going to use against you, which is going to be harmful to you, and that is those statements that you make off the top of your head that you honest to God believe are the gospel truth. 25% of that's false, and as they write those down and take them on the dictaphone machine or they take them on the tape recorder, they'll then turn around and use those against you because it's inevitable that you're going to make these mistakes. Now, in some cases, it may be a direct intentional lie. In some cases, it may be just a misstatement. I answered yes when I should have answered no. I was so damn tired and I was so frazzled that I didn't know what I was saying. That's all right. They've got it down. They've got a transcript of every word that you uttered. And this is why it's so important, and this is why judges over the years have come to the conclusion that it's very important that you keep your mouth shut. And in some cases, like Brown v. Texas, they have taken prosecutors and the police to task and said, hey, you can't do that. Now, going on with the story here, it was held that the application of the Texas statute to detain the appellant and to require him to identify himself violated the Fourth Amendment because the officers lacked any reasonable suspicion to believe that the appellant was engaged or had engaged in any criminal conduct. Detaining the appellant to require him to identify himself constituted a seizure of his person, subject to the requirement of the Fourth Amendment that the seizure be reasonable. And they cite Terry versus Ohio and United States versus Brignani-Ponce. The Fourth Amendment requires that such a seizure be based upon specific, objective facts, indicating that society's legitimate interests require such action, or that the seizure be carried out pursuant to a plan embodying explicit neutral limitations on the conduct of individual officers, as we see in Delaware versus Prowse. Here, the state does not contend that the appellant was stopped pursuant to a practice embodying neutral criteria, and the officer's actions were not justified on the grounds that they had a reasonable suspicion based upon objective facts that he was involved in some criminal activity. So, absent any basis for suspecting the appellant of misconduct, the balance between the public interest in crime prevention and the appellant's right to personal security and privacy tilts in favor of freedom from police interference. Now, the Chief Justice, Justice Berger, delivered the opinion of the court, and he said, "This appeal presents the question as to whether the appellant was validly convicted for refusing to comply with a policeman's demand that he identify himself pursuant to a provision of the Texas Penal Code which makes it a crime to refuse such identification on request." Okay. Now, there's a distinction here between the policeman just walking up to you and saying, "Hey, I'm making this spot check," like Delaware versus Prowse, random search, and whether or not there were specific objective facts. And then there's a question as to whether or not your state has a statute that requires you to identify yourself to the police officer. If you're in one of those 26 states that don't require it, then that puts a different light on the subject. I mean, think about it. Policeman comes up to you and he says, "I want to see some identification." And you say, "No." The policeman says, "If you don't identify yourself, I'm going to arrest you. Please do." The policeman arrests you and takes you to the police station. Now he has searched you. He has your wallet and all of your identification. Hell, you might as well have told him up front. Let's suppose now, for the sake of our discussion, you don't carry any identification on you. How's that? You don't carry a wallet. You don't have a social security number. Don't have a driver's license. Now, how is he going to identify you? Well, typically, you know, when he picked you up, there was somebody with you, and so they question that somebody, and he says, "Oh, that's Joe." See? What if you're by yourself in a strange town with no identification, walking down the street, and the policeman says, "Geez, I've never seen you before. Identify yourself." And you say, "No." They arrest you, haul you off to jail. They charge you with obstructing and delaying an officer in the performance of his duty. And they try mightily. They do everything in their power to identify you. They take your fingerprints. They run them through NCIC. You've never had your fingerprints on file before, and they just absolutely cannot identify you. Does that mean then they have to turn you loose because they can't identify you, so therefore they can't prosecute you? Do you believe that? Boys and girls, there's a number of cases in the literature where they prosecute you under the name John Doe. We don't need your identification to prosecute you. So identification is a red herring from the get-go. Let's suppose we did this. You're in a strange town. You've never been arrested before. You walk into the bank and you rob it. You escape. They chase you down the street and catch you. You've got all the loot with all of the red dye all over you, all over the money, all over the money bag. You didn't wear any mask, and so the bank teller says, "That's the man that robbed me. Got you dead to rights." But you refuse to identify yourself. You've got no wallet. You've got no identification. Your fingerprints aren't on file. And the police try mightily to identify you, and they cannot connect a name with you. Do you believe, honest to God, do you believe the police now have to turn you loose because they couldn't connect a name with you, so therefore we can't prosecute you? Boys and girls, you will be prosecuted under the name John Doe, convicted and jailed and released from prison under the name John Doe. We don't need any identification for you. Come on, let's wake up and smell the coffee here. Identification is as phony as a $3 bill. Well, at least insofar as crime is concerned. What's really neat and handy when we have your name, social security number, and your birth date is that we can tie you into NCIC, we can tie you into college, high school. Hell, we've got your whole record from the day you were born until today right in front of us that we can use against you. And that's the purpose for identification. We're trying to get evidence against you. Well, here's the rest of the story. At 12:45 in the afternoon of December 9th, 1977, officers Venegas and Sotelo of the El Paso Police Department were cruising in a patrol car. They observed the appellant and another man walking in opposite directions away from one another in an alley. And although the two men were a few feet apart when they were first seen, Officer Venegas later testified that both officers believed that the two had been together or were about to meet until the patrol car appeared. The car entered the alley, and Officer Venegas got out and asked the appellant to identify himself and explain what he was doing there. The other man was not questioned, nor was he detained. The officer testified that he stopped the appellant because the situation looked suspicious and that he had never seen the subject in that area before. The area of El Paso where the appellant was stopped was a high or has a high incidence of drug traffic. However, the officers did not claim to suspect the appellant of any specific misconduct, nor did they have any reason to believe that he was armed. The appellant refused to identify himself, and he angrily asserted that the officers had no right to stop him. Officer Venegas replied that he was in a high drug problem area, and that Officer Sotelo then frisked the appellant, but he found nothing. When the appellant continued to refuse to identify himself, he was arrested for violation of the Texas Penal Code, which makes it a criminal act for a person to refuse to give his name and address to the officer, who has lawfully stopped him and requested the information. So following the arrest, the officer searched the appellant. Nothing was found. So while being taken to the El Paso County Jail, the appellant identified himself. Nonetheless, he was held in custody and charged with violating the statute. When he was booked, he was routinely searched a third time. Then the appellant was convicted in the El Paso Municipal Court and fined $20 plus court costs. He then exercised his right under Texas law to a trial de novo in the El Paso County Court. There, he moved to set aside the information on the grounds that the Texas Penal Code violated the First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments and was unconstitutionally vague in violation of the 14th Amendment. The motion was denied. The appellant waived a jury, and the court convicted him and imposed a fine of $45 plus court costs. Under Texas law, an appeal from an inferior court to a county court is subject to further review only if a fine exceeding $100 is imposed. So accordingly, the county court's rejection of the appellant's constitutional claims was a decision by the highest court of the state of Texas in which a decision could be had. On appeal, we noted probable jurisdiction, and we reverse that conviction. Now, this is pretty unusual. You think about the costs involved of taking a case clear to the United States Supreme Court over something as trivial, apparently as trivial, as identifying yourself to the policeman. And on review, the U.S. Supreme Court took the case on. Look, the total fine in this case is $65. He went into the Justice of the Peace and said, "We're going to fine you $20 because you wouldn't cooperate with the policeman." Normal people pay the $20 and walk out the door. Well, $20 plus court costs. This guy says, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to appeal to the county court, which he did. This is called a trial de novo. He tries the case, waives the jury trial. There are only legal issues involved here. That's why he waived the jury trial. No factual issues. He agreed. The policeman asked me who I was, and I told him, kiss off. I ain't telling. He charged me with failing to identify myself in violation of the statute, and the judge found him guilty. Open and shut case. Fined him $45. Now, he didn't pay the $20 fine, because if he had of, then he couldn't have appealed. So, now the fine jumps from $20 to $45, but you can't appeal to your state court of appeals or the state Supreme Court in Texas unless the fine is $100 or more. And so, there's a rule that comes down. He now has a final decision from the highest court in the state of Texas, which happens to be the district court out here in some little, El Paso, Texas. whatever that county is. And so he appeals directly to the U.S. Supreme Court, and wouldn't you know it, they took the case on and adjudicated it. Hell, this man's famous now. He's written up in the literature. Brown v. Texas. That could happen to you. You could be immortalized like Miranda versus Arizona. Brown v. Texas. Joe Sixpack versus Los Angeles County. I mean, you know, things like that happen. Now, let's notice here that when the officers detained the appellant for the purpose of requiring him to identify himself, they performed a seizure of his person subject to the requirements of the Fourth Amendment. In convicting the appellant, the county court necessarily found, as a matter of fact, that the officers had lawfully stopped the appellant. Now, the Fourth Amendment, of course, applies to all seizures of the person, including seizures that involve only a brief detention short of a traditional arrest. See Davis versus Mississippi, Terry versus Ohio. So whenever a police officer accosts an individual and restrains his freedom to walk away, he has seized that person at, and the Fourth Amendment requires that the seizure be reasonable. Right? So now he has seized the person. Is this seizure reasonable? Well, we don't know until we get to an appellate review, do we? Maybe it is. Let's suppose the seizure was reasonable. Does he still have a duty to confess and identify himself? Well, what if you believe? Let's try this on precise. What if you believed that the seizure was unreasonable and violated your Fourth Amendment rights, but the policeman believes that the seizure is reasonable and doesn't violate your rights, but meanwhile he's arrested you and charged you with this crime? Well, who's going to decide this? If you acquiesce to the policeman, well, then you've waived your Fourth Amendment right. And if you don't, then he has arrested and jailed you, hasn't he? Right. So now what we need is we need an arbiter to come in here. This is what adjudication is all about. We need some third party to come in here, listen to this, and then make a decision, don't we? So the reasonableness of seizures that are less intrusive than a traditional arrest, such as Terry versus Ohio, depends upon a balance between the public interest and the individual's right to personal security, free from arbitrary interference by law enforcement officers. Now, consideration of the constitutionality of such seizures involves a weighing of the gravity of the public concerns served by the seizure, the degree to which the seizure advances the public interest, and the severity of the interference with individual liberty. A central concern in balancing these competing considerations in a variety of settings has been to assure that an individual's reasonable expectation of privacy is not subject to arbitrary invasions solely at the unfettered discretion of officers in the field. To this end, the Fourth Amendment requires that a seizure must be based on specific objective facts, indicating that society's legitimate interests require the seizure of the particular individual, or that the seizure must be carried out pursuant to a plan embodying explicit neutral limitations on the conduct of individual officers. The state does not contend that the appellant was stopped pursuant to a practice embodying neutral criteria, but rather maintains that the officers were justified in stopping the appellant because they had a reasonable, articulable suspicion that a crime had just been, was being, or was about to be committed. And we have recognized that in some circumstances, an officer may detain a suspect briefly for questioning, although he does not have probable cause to believe that the suspect is involved in criminal activity, as is required for a traditional arrest. However, we have required the officers to have a reasonable suspicion, based upon objective facts, that the individual is involved in criminal activity. The flaw in the state's case is that none of the circumstances preceding the officer's detention of the appellant justified a reasonable suspicion that he was involved in criminal conduct. Officer Venegas testified at the appellant's trial that the situation in the alley looked suspicious, but he was unable to point to any facts supporting that conclusion. There is no indication in the record that it was unusual for people to be in the alley. The fact that the appellant was in a neighborhood frequented by drug users, standing alone, isn't any basis for concluding that the appellant himself was engaged in any criminal conduct with drugs. In short, the appellant's activity was no different from the activity of other pedestrians in that neighborhood. And when pressed, Officer Venegas acknowledged that the only reason he stopped the appellant was to ascertain his identity. The record suggests an understandable desire to assert a police presence. However, that purpose does not negate Fourth Amendment guarantees. Now, in the absence of any basis for suspecting the appellant of misconduct, the balance between the public interest and the appellant's right to personal security and privacy tilts in favor of the freedom from police interference. The Texas statute under which the appellant was stopped and required to identify himself is designed to advance a weighty social objective in large metropolitan centers, and that is the prevention of crime. But even assuming that purpose is served to some degree by stopping and demanding identification from an individual without any specific basis for believing that he is involved in any criminal activity, the guarantees of the Fourth Amendment do not allow it. When such a stop is not based on objective criteria, the risk of arbitrary and abusive police practices exceeds tolerable limits. All right, so if you think about it now in pragmatic terms, if the policeman stops you, arrests you, and jails you, and violates your rights in the process, your remedy is to sue him for false arrest and false imprisonment. However, in this case, even if it were determined that the police had every right in the world to stop this guy and to ask him for his identification, the real question to be decided here is, does he have any corresponding duty to identify himself? If the police did in fact have the right to stop him and ask him for his identification, all that does is say, well, he can't sue them for false arrest and false imprisonment, which he didn't do anyway. He never came back. Brown didn't come back and say, hey, I've been falsely arrested and imprisoned. The state went a step further and said, well, because you exercised your Fourth Amendment right to remain silent, or your Fifth Amendment right to remain silent, and your Fourth Amendment right to be secure in your person, means that we're going to charge you with a crime on top of that. Hey, hang on a second here. Is it a crime to remain silent? Do you remember Jesus, when he was being prosecuted before Pilate, remained silent? And Pilate was amazed. He said, don't you know that I have the power to crucify you? And the Messiah told him, he said, you wouldn't have any power over me at all unless it were given to you. Jesus thought that the power, the right to remain silent, was as much a part of free speech as being able to go out and talk to people. And he exercised it. And that's my point. The power of speech is a fundamental right, but the power to remain silent is just as much a right. Hey, we're out of time. I got to remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. Now, the law school is a private, non-profit, non-commercial, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.